What if the heroes we celebrate aren't heroes at all, but charming con artists who got away with it? During the 1960s, as Americans questioned everything from Vietnam to Watergate, Noel B. Gerson published a book that dared to suggest something unsettling. We've always preferred our icons slightly dirty. The Great American Rascal wasn't just a historical curiosity. It became a mirror held up to a nation built on audacity, deception, and the peculiar belief that breaking the rules is somehow more American than following them. Consider P.T. Barnum, who filled Madison Square Garden with thousands eager to see his Fiji mermaid, actually a monkey's torso sewn to a fishtail. When exposed, the crowds didn't revolt. They applauded his ingenuity. Or Daniel Drew, the cattle driver who invented watered stock by feeding his herd salt before market, then letting them drink their fill to inflate their weight. Wall Street adopted his term, not as condemnation, but as professional vocabulary. These weren't aberrations in American character. They were expressions of it. The book forces us to confront an uncomfortable truth. We don't just tolerate our rascals, we enshrine them. Born into American aristocracy, grandson of theologian Jonathan Edwards, son of Princeton's president, Aaron Burr seemed destined for greatness. Rejected from Princeton at 13 for being too young, he returned at 15 to demolish the curriculum, graduating with top honors at 16. Yet something was missing. While contemporaries caught revolutionary fever, debating liberty and natural rights with genuine passion, Burr remained detached. He pursued fencing, marksmanship, and philosophy with equal intensity, not as expressions of principle, but as tools for advancement. His romantic relationships followed the same pattern: strategic alliances with prominent families, calculated steps up his ladder of ambition. The fatal flaw was evident. Burr possessed everything except the quality that transforms talent into legacy, a core of principle transcending personal gain. He was building a magnificent structure on sand. When General Washington rejected young Burr's volunteer service in 1775, refusing to make an inexperienced idealist an officer, he planted seeds of lasting resentment. Burr found his opening in Benedict Arnold's nightmare expedition to Quebec, a journey that killed more men through starvation and exposure than enemy fire. Yet, where others collapsed, Burr thrived. "I have never been so happy in my life," he wrote, while hacking through impenetrable wilderness. The assault on Quebec became his defining moment, leading 50 men in a nighttime attack, retrieving his fallen commander's body under fire, commanding the rear guard at Long Island. These actions marked him as a soldier of genuine distinction. Yet, consuming rivalries took root. His brief stint as Washington's aide ended badly. The role was too constraining. More fatefully, his path kept crossing with Alexander Hamilton's, the immigrant orphan whose trajectory to Washington's inner circle stood in stark contrast to Burr's privileged but less favored position. Two brilliant men, both hungry for recognition, both convinced of their superiority. History loves such collisions. Illness ended Burr's military career in 1779, launching him into law, where he built an elite practice. His marriage to Theodosia Prevost brought a daughter who became his emotional center. Believing in women's intellectual equality, Burr gave young Theodosia an unprecedented education, classical languages, mathematics, philosophy, decades ahead of his time. Post-revolutionary New York became his political proving ground. Elected to the State Assembly in 1784, he refused factional loyalty, neither Federalist nor Democratic-Republican, just Burr. This studied neutrality built cross-party relationships but bred toxic suspicion. What does Burr actually believe? His 1791 Senate victory over General Philip Scheuer, Hamilton's father-in-law, elevated him nationally while transforming Hamilton's animosity into something darker. To Hamilton, Burr wasn't merely a rival, he was a dangerous chameleon, a man of no fixed principles when the era desperately needed them. Hamilton wasn't entirely wrong. The 1800 election should have crowned Burr's success. As Jefferson's running mate, he delivered New York's crucial votes. But a flawed electoral system created an unintended tie between them. Burr remained silent through 36 ballots. Was this ambition or constitutional process? Jefferson prevailed through Hamilton's influence, making Burr a political pariah despite his vice presidency. Jefferson excluded him from power. His 1804 gubernatorial campaign ended in defeat, again with Hamilton working against him. When Burr learned Hamilton called him a dangerous man, the code of honor left little choice. On July 11, 1804, they met at Weehawken. Hamilton's bullet went high, Burr's struck with deadly accuracy. Hamilton died the next day. Burr became a fugitive. His political career ended in those few seconds. The duel marked the moment when America's revolutionary generation began consuming itself. With his career destroyed, Burr launched his most audacious scheme, a conspiracy to either separate Western territories from the United States or invade Spanish Mexico. His true intentions remain debated. He left deliberately vague plans and contradictory explanations. By 1806, he had secured an island base on the Ohio River and begun gathering men and supplies. But his co-conspirator, General James Wilkinson, betrayed him to Jefferson. Captured in Alabama, Burr stood trial for treason in Richmond. Chief Justice John Marshall established that treason requires an overt act witnessed by two people. On September 1, 1807, the jury acquitted him. Legally exonerated but disgraced, Burr fled to Europe, spending four desperate years courting Britain, Sweden, and Napoleon for support. Living in poverty and gambling to survive, he maintained dignity while his dreams crumbled. When he returned in 1812, America had forgotten him. Then fate delivered its cruelest blow. His beloved daughter Theodosia disappeared at sea, her ship vanishing without trace. Aaron Burr lived another 24 years after Theodosia's death, rebuilding a modest legal practice and maintaining dignity in reduced circumstances. At 77, he even married again, a union that quickly dissolved into litigation. He maintained stoic silence about his controversial past, carefully preserving his papers but declining to publish memoirs. When death came in 1836, the last major figure of the founding generation had passed. What are we to make of this brilliant, flawed, enigmatic man? Burr possessed gifts that rivaled Hamilton's or Jefferson's. His military courage was unquestioned, his legal mind formidable, his personal charm legendary. Yet, he lacked something essential, a core of principle that transcended personal ambition. His progressive views on women's education and opposition to slavery speak to admirable qualities, but his legacy remains defined by the moments when ambition overcame judgment. Perhaps Burr's greatest tragedy was his inability to recognize that in a republic, enduring power must rest on public trust. The very qualities that made him effective as a lawyer and military commander, tactical flexibility, willingness to adapt, undermined his effectiveness as a political leader in a system built on transparent principles. More than two centuries later, Burr still fascinates us precisely because he defies easy categorization. In him, we see both the democratic promise of talent rising regardless of birth and the dangers of unchecked ambition. We are still the country that produced him, brilliant, ambitious, morally flexible, convinced that the rules don't quite apply to us. His life poses questions we still haven't answered. How do we balance personal aspiration against public good? And when our moment on history stage has passed, how will we be remembered?